listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at jackiedaily.com. Jackie with no E, daily like every day.com. And from there, you can subscribe for free wherever you like to find your podcasts. It could be iTunes, iHeart, Spotify, Stitcher, TheBlaze.com, whatever your pleasure. You can find me there. My videos live there. I'm about to make some new videos that you will enjoy. Yes, and very special, very special. And as always, you can continue to continue the conversation with me online on Twitter at Jackie Daily Host, on Facebook, The Jackie Daily Show, or Instagram, Jackie Daily. All right, so I'm so happy because I get to have my former boss, Congressman Trent Franks, back on the show. He has been an oil man since he was 11 years old. He's going to tell you true stories from the oil patch, starting with the fact that he inherited a pickup truck with a cab on it while he was living in Colorado at age 11, and promptly drove that pickup truck at age 11 to New Mexico to take his first job in the oil patch. Yes, he was breaking the law. That was the 1970s. Things were different. He has been working in oil and gas since that time, now specializing in Australia. He was offshore, working with Conoco for these monster wells of natural gas that will probably help to fuel Asia because they have an endless thirst and need, having very little resources of their own. Now he's onshore in Australia, but he's been everywhere. I mean, he's drilled in California. He was the youngest driller ever, it is believed, in the state of Texas. He bought his own rig when he was 17, and his brother was 15, and the two of them drilled dry holes all over Texas as teenagers and later became a little more successful. So he's going to tell true stories from the oil patch. I'm going to make him tell you the story about him being present when someone was struck by lightning in the oil patch and how flames shot from their hands. And they lived through it, actually. He has 1,000 stories. They're terrific. And he also will explain his view of why his business is what saves the world, feeds the world. We would not be able to support almost 8 billion people on this planet without his business. There is no way. We would die. If you cut off fossil fuels tomorrow, millions and probably billions of people would die. And he'll make that case. So that is coming up. And then I'm going to talk to you about oil spills. We're going to talk about, you know, the latest oil spill reported in the press and contrast that to what happens in nature. It turns out nature seeps oil and natural gas onto the ocean floor and onto the ground constantly. Oil spills happen all day, every day, naturally. And you don't want that in your lake, okay, that you get your water from. But oil is a natural product. Mother Nature makes it. And in fact, this is how oil and gas was discovered in the first place. In these places like Pennsylvania or like Azerbaijan, Baku, where it is so close to the surface that people couldn't miss it. Like Jed Clampett shooting into the ground in Tennessee. That's Hollywood. But actually, it's not too far from the truth. I mean, there really is something in Azerbaijan, which is north of Iran, south of Russia. I've been there, called the Burning Mountain. Azerbaijan translates to land of fire, because literally there is a mountain there. It's more like a hill by my standards. I'm from Appalachia, but it's been on fire for as long as humankind can remember. It never, ever extinguishes because the hydrocarbons, kids, that's oil, gas, or coal, is so close to the surface that literally it just continuously fuels a fire on the ground in Azerbaijan. It's natural. Maybe this is what the burning bush was for Moses. I don't know. It's entirely possible. So, as you might also know, they have a god there in that part of the world called Zoroaster, or Zoroaster, right? And he's a god of fire. And some people still follow that faith in Iran, in Azerbaijan, I believe Freddie Mercury was of that faith, right? In any event, the point is, I'm going to tell you what your U.S. government has to say about natural oil seepage on the ground in the ocean. I'll tell you what the U.S. Geological Survey says about it, and what the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is your repository for all your climate data, if you're an American. It is the government repository of all climate information, and I will read to you directly from their website about oil seepage, natural oil seepage onto the ground and into the ocean. It is natural. It's happening right now. It is not a crisis. It's not something to solve. It's not something to worry about. And so, you know, I'm just saying, if there's an oil spill in the middle of nowhere, South Dakota, of a few hundred barrels of oil, how does that really compare to what Mother Nature drops on the ground every single day? This is a question worth asking. So, I think it's there's a trend out there that we take things that are entirely natural, and because we just discovered them, or maybe a humankind played a hand in, let's say, an oil spill, somehow this is assumed to be a tragedy or a crisis. But in fact, oil on the ground is very natural in certain quantities, okay? So, you're going to feel a lot better after we talk about it, I think. And then I'm going to go through mail from listeners. I love to hear from you. Please be encouraged to write to me. You can find me, as I said, on Facebook, on Twitter, or you can talk to me through the website, JackieDaily.com. Love to hear from you, and I will share with you some of the mail that I received from listeners and some of the articles that they sent to me that they think I should share with you. I receive far more suggestions for articles, books to review, a guest to interview than I can possibly act upon. So don't be offended if I didn't share your article. I just have a lot going on for a two-hour weekend show. Okay. It's just a lot of stuff. But thank you for writing to me. Love to hear from you. Be encouraged. Follow me on Twitter at Jackie Daily Host again. And finally, I have here from the day trading community, the investing community, the best projections that I think exist on planet Earth for the weather for the next few weeks. Number one, expect a white Christmas. Number two, expect extremely cold weather in North America. So Texas, you could have a repeat of what happened in the winter storm of February 2021. We've been through this before. You are now prepared. You know what to do. But I'm going to devote a segment to reminding you of all the things you can do to get ready if your grid goes down again and you have no power. Last time it went on for days, depending on where you were, especially in the capital city of Austin. You would think it would be the opposite. But in fact, people there suffered as badly as anywhere. There were hundreds of deaths in Texas. This is a life or death issue. Not having power is a life or death issue, especially if you're on life support or you need dialysis, or, you know, you're stranded somewhere in the middle of nowhere and can't get to prescription meds or whatever you need. Hundreds of deaths. We don't have to have that. It's totally unnecessary. Until I can convince the people at the State House to change their policy and make sure we have enough power as we always have had for the last, I don't know how many decades, you know, and get this fixed. We're working on it. Until that time, Texans, everyone, it's up to you. Do not rely on the government to take care of you. Ask the people from Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans when the government's going to come and help you. It could be a long time if they ever do. I mean, there's disaster after disaster. You find out it's every man for himself and his family and friends and community. So please stock up now. The time to hoard is now. Don't make a run on the gas station when there's a hurricane. Make it now. Fill up all of your tanks, everything. I mean, everywhere you can put fuel, in your lawnmower, in your weed eater, in your snowblower, whatever, please. And keep as much on site legally and safely as you can. Also, I would stock up on hunting gear. And not just ammo and guns. I'm talking about bows and arrows. Whatever you need to keep yourself alive in a really bad situation, please do it now. Emergency food is always a good idea, and so are generators. Okay, I have a lot more to say about it, but I'm out of time. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online, jackiedaily.com, and subscribe for free at iHeartRadio, Spotify, iTunes, and others. I have on the line one of my favorite guests and one of my first guests of all time on the show, way back when I was at Kid Craddock Studios, way back when I was on KLIF Dallas, Congressman Trent Franks, who is an oil man by background and yet again, but when I knew him best, he was Congressman Trent Franks from Phoenix, Arizona, and my boss for a long time during some of the most exciting and fun years of my career. So always fun to have him on the show. Congressman Franks, welcome back.
I am so grateful to be back with you, Jackie. You know, I can't help. I know I'm going to embarrass you, but I will say to you that, you know, you have all kinds of staffers and people that you work with in Congress, but I never worked with a more capable, more intelligent, more committed, more principled person in all of my career in Congress. And I know you're out there doing great things, and this radio program is part of it, but you will always have my deepest respect and gratitude for who you are and what you've always stood up for. I mean, you're just a pretty cool person, okay? I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for that. That is so kind and so sweet. There is no one better with words, really, than Congressman Trent Franks. He was the silver-tongued orator of the Congress, and everyone knew it. Nicknamed the poet, because Trent Franks speaks in its poetry. So you are in for a treat, and I know you. Every time you tell this story, we true stories are the best. Every time you tell the story I'm going to ask you to tell, you say, now, I'll lose credibility with you if I tell you the full truth about the story. But so maybe I shouldn't start here, but it's just too cool. Please explain to the listeners how you became an oil man at the age of 11.
Wow. Well, first of all, I'm the one that's going to be embarrassed now that she's said all these things about any articulation ability on my part, because I will tell you that the listeners will realize that I'm not just being humbled here in a few moments. But the truth is that I had the privilege. And first of all, I had a grandfather, Jackie, as you know, that was an old world wildcatter. It was Willard C. Franks. He was one of the great champions in my life, and I loved him. And he passed away about a few months after I entered the legislature. He was considered for the U.S. Senate in Colorado many, many, many decades. I think it was in the 40s. And he was just a champion and a great Republican, a great conservative. And so I have to start kind of there, because he in a sense, catalyzed my interest in both areas of the political arena and in the oil and gas arena. And so he was just a great man. Then my dad did some things, and I worked with him, helped him, and did some things with him. And I went to work as sort of a gopher, I would call it, on a Bucyrus 36L cable tube drilling rig in Regina, New Mexico, when I was 11. And that's crazy. I have a 14-year-old son, and I wouldn't let him get near a drilling rig if I had anything to say about it. But that's the truth. And then I was actually running the rig part-time when I was 13, in daylight hours, doing a daylight driller's job at times. And, you know, those things stay with you. And so when I was 17, my younger brother, who's my hero in life, Lane Franks, he and I were able to buy a little junk drilling rig, and I call it a junk drilling rig. We thought it was 100 National at the time. We thought it was the greatest rig in the world. It was mounted on a Ford 600 truck, and it was a little Western 1000 drilling rig, and it was made to drill 1,000 feet. But boy, I don't know if it could do it. But we came to Putnam, Texas, and we drilled our first well, and it was a dry hole. Broke our hearts. but it also broke us into the business. And just a few years later, they came in and drilled within a stone's throw about 150 feet deeper and hit a blowout at a shallow depth. And it probably would have destroyed our rig. We were so brokenhearted at the time that we didn't have more pipe to drill deeper, because we were just sure, of course, that the bonanza was deeper. But if we had drilled deeper, we didn't even have surface casing. At that time, they had a special rule on shallow drilling where you could circulate cement on your production string in lieu of surface casing. The bottom line, though, is you didn't have any capability to prevent a blowout if it occurred, and it most certainly would have. Had we been able to go deeper, it would have destroyed our rig, and who knows, it might have taken our lives. I just don't know. But the bottom line is we have some wonderful memories as a result. We were the youngest drilling contractors in the state of Texas.
Wow. Now you left out the first step of that journey, the great part of the story for those of us even who are not oil and gas people by background. You drove to your first job at age 11.
I did.
To New Mexico. You left out the part about law breaking. Okay, yeah, tell them how you got from Colorado to New Mexico.
True. That is true. I drove a camper pickup on a 66 half-ton Dodge pickup with a camper on it from Briggsdale, Colorado to Regina, New Mexico when I was 11. Now, that was crazy. that was crazy, and I admit it. I had a sofa seat under me and a big coat and my dad's hat. And so I looked, you know, I was tall at the time, but so I looked like I was an adult, but I sure wasn't. And anyway, to the grand law enforcement agencies of the Southwest and the western half of the United States, you have my sincere apologies and my gratitude for not scrutinizing the situation more carefully than you did.
But you know what? That's the makeup of a wildcatter. That's the makeup of an oil man, right? These are the great stories.
Being stupid and out of your mind is pretty much a prerequisite. I would stipulate to that.
But you know what it is? You have to have courage, and you have to believe. You have to have dreams. And I think of Texas kind of as the land of dreams. Yeah, I left Washington to come here because I thought of Texas as being kind of romantic and kind of magical in my mind.
Yeah,
and yes, you can dream big here and be big here. Anything can happen here. And you came here to become the youngest driller in Texas history, as far as I know and you know. And I came here, among other things, to start this show. So, you know, here are dreams realized all together at once. And I should note that you are still, to this day, an oil man, still in oil and gas. All these decades later, that's like about, you're celebrating more than 50 years in the business, I believe, or you're awfully close if you're not.
Well, yeah, we don't need to discuss specifics there, Jackie, but you're unfortunately closer than I'd like for you to be.
but it's a beautiful thing. And
yes, it is.
And you have so many great stories. I wasn't planning on just telling stories, but you know what? People love stories. I'm going to make you tell. I have 3 minutes. I have to do it. Tell the true story about what happens when you get hit by lightning when you're near an oil rig.
Well, it's just when the lightning strikes here, it's just like the glory of God. I mean, all you can do is run. And, of course, anybody that stays close to a drilling rig in a lightning storm has definitely lost their mind. Now, that crosses over into the whole rubric of insanity. And you got to be crazy to be a drilling contractor and a little bit out of your mind on some levels, but to stand around a drilling rig in a lightning storm is really crazy. And when lightning strikes, you may be talking about, Jackie, I just now remember which story you're talking about. We were standing the rig up in a machine shop in Abilene, Texas, and one of the cables went over and touched a power line. Is that the story you're talking about, or is the one in Kentucky where lightning struck and we were out there having to run away from the rig?
What I recall is fire coming out of someone's hands.
Yes, that's the machine shop. What happened was we were on the deck of the rig and we were pulling some Kelly bushings in out of a pickup, and the cable went over and touched a 14,000-volt power line, and the power came down through, and there was a gentleman that was leaning on the pickup truck, and the power went through him, and there were flames coming from his hands into the pickup truck, 6 or 8 inches long. And when we finally were accidentally able to pull the cable, because we didn't mean to, we were just trying to dive out of the way, we accidentally pulled the cable off the power line, and the power stopped, and he just fell backwards It had burned holes in his shoes, and we were quite convinced that he had died. And yet they took him to the hospital, and a few days later he was sitting up in his bed, and the last that we heard, God bless him, he was in good health. So I was thankful for that. But we literally saw the flames coming from his hands going into the edge of the pickup box. So that's got to be the story you're talking about. And yep, that's an absolutely true story.
That is almost like an Old Testament story, right? Like this is
it
like
is.
A, one
is.
Of those Moses
yeah.
stories. Fire,
yeah.
flames,
yeah.
But
right.
but true stories.
Elijah. I don't think his name was Elijah, but it could have been. Maybe he was one of those prophets that got away. I don't know.
It all worked out for him. So it was a happy ending.
Yes, it did.
A story
yes,
with a happy ending. Okay, I have to go to break. But when I come back, I'm going to continue the conversation with Congressman Trent Franks, my former boss. He's still an oil and gas man, but now has his eyes on Australia, which is frankly an energy powerhouse. If you don't know, we don't talk about Australia a lot around here in Texas, but there's a lot happening down there. So we'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Congressman Trent Franks. He's out of Phoenix, Arizona. He's my former boss on Capitol Hill back when he used to chair the Subcommittee on the Constitution and was a member of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. Now he has returned to the oil and gas business. And though he is based in Arizona, his big project right now is in Australia. And not his first. Australia is truly a leader in natural gas production. They've got oil there. They've got coal there. This little island, actually it's a huge island with a little population, has a lot going for it. And it happens to be the neighbor, loosely speaking, of the large Asian countries that seem to have an endless thirst for power. And frankly, where you want to be, if you want to lock in long-term agreements to get contracts to develop all this energy. So Congressman Franks, first, tell us about your experience offshore in the Browse Basin, just because your story there is some of the most exciting and part of what got me interested in oil and gas in the first place.
Well, you know, I have to squeeze in here just a little item that when I was the chairman of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Jackie was the brains of it. She was the chief counsel. And so it made my job easier. She was great for what she was chief counsel of our office and pretty much the smartest person in the office, which was embarrassing in my case. But the truth is Australia is, as you say, it is a powerhouse. There's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, it is, I believe, one of the more mineral-rich places in the world, and it has a very stable government. The people there of Australia are wonderful, wonderful people, and their noble hearts and attitudes, and I sometimes get a little discouraged that somehow the left has co-opted some of their governmental institutions, but the people there are extremely self-starting, and they're very responsible, very noble, fun people. And so we've had just an amazing time. We've been in Australia now. Let's see. Liberty is 24 years old. We started in Australia in 1996 with one company, and then we became Liberty a little bit later. So it's as you can see, it's been a long time. It's been, I think, about 26 years, I think, since we started into Australia, something like that. And the truth is, we were very fortunate. We've had a lot of good things happen there. We've drilled some dry holes there. But we've really done a lot of activity there. And you mentioned the Poseidon, the offshore Browse Basin. We were able to win a bid on a lease up there that was approximately a million acre lease offshore. And it was a long ways offshore, but we thought it had a lot of prospectivity. And without mentioning, well, I can mention a couple of the companies, but we worked with some companies early on to develop seismic and to really do a geological workup on the project. And later we were able to have a farm in from Conoco, and they drilled, and they were wonderful to work with. They just did an excellent job. And on our first major well, there's called the Poseidon Number 1, we hit a huge gas reserve there, and Conoco proceeded to spend close to $1 billion on that project. And they brought in, they drilled eight, what I would call appraisal wells, to really get a size of the picture of the, and scope of the reserve. And I think that reserve, of course, you know, there's official estimates, and then there's the estimates that you actually think are true. But I think that reserve will end up somewhere around 5 to 7 trillion cubic feet. And it's a long ways offshore, but I think it's going to be a major source of gas going forward. And yes, you are correct that companies, especially the Asian countries and the countries in around Japan and Indonesia and places like that, they really do have a strong thrust in trying to go into Australia and get a hold of in the ground reserves so that they can survive going forward. Because, you know, there's this gigantic effort on the part of the left to demonize fossil fuels. And I understand that. I mean, they first of all, most of the time, have any idea what they're talking about. They don't realize that fossil fuels, whatever else you might say about them, they power the world in a sense. About 80%+ of all of the machine energy in the world comes from fossil fuels. And that has empowered and caused human flourishing like very few other things that we've ever come up with. And this has provided energy for an industrialized world. It's caused millions of people to just merely be able to live, but it's also caused billions of people to be able to have food and meaning and purpose in life, and to be able to do things that they could never otherwise have done apart from fossil fuels. And ultimately, with those trying to do away with fossil fuels entirely, they don't have a real solution to a replacement. The very people that are against fossil fuels are against nuclear energy, which is the one energy that might be able to someday replace fossil fuels. But for now, we're going to need fossil fuels for some time in the future, not less, but more. Probably the one reference I would make, and then I'll take a breath here, Jackie, is the book by Epstein. I think his name is Alex Epstein, called Fossil Future.
Yeah.
People will read that book. They will understand why there are those of us that say we have a physics issue here. We can freeze to death, or we can and come to a halt as an industrialized people, or we can make the best use of fossil fuels, the cleanest way that we can do it for the time that they are still desperately needed.
Yes. And Alex has been on the show, too, a few times. First for his book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Yep. And then I attended his book release party in Newport Beach for for Fossil Future. So, okay, back to Asia. When you say Japan, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that for them, World War II, whether it's Pearl Harbor or whatever, it was about energy. It was about access to fossil fuels. Basically, the Japanese were formidable. I mean, nobody wanted to go up against them. But if you cut off their fuel, because they have so little natural resources of their own, which is amazing, that they could be such a dominant country with so little. But the key for us in the war was cutting off their fossil fuels. And that was key. Well, it triggered the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And then, of course, the end of the war eventually. But this is how serious this is, right? This is war and peace.
Yes.
This is life and death. I mean, if we don't
Correct.
Get these resources moved, this is what can happen. So I feel like what you're doing, and I said when I started my show, it's about preventing World War III.
It really is, Jackie. And I tell you, I've always admired your insight, but it is obviously still completely intact, because this is not a debate over, you know, an academic discussion.
Right.
This is, as you call it, a life and death situation. What people don't realize, if Adolf Hitler had the fuel that he so desperately needed for his war machine, the entire World War II may have come out very differently. And we may all be speaking German if we were, intact at all. And I can't express sometimes to people how desperately important energy is to modern human life. If you're going to talk about human flourishing, you cannot do so without vast and reasonably affordable energy. You just can't do it. It's vitally important to almost everything that we do as a human race. And our friends on the left, or our friends that want to wipe out the sources of fossil fuel, they do so in the name of not impacting the world. But they don't realize that fossil fuels have impacted the world in terms of human flourishing in a wonderful, positive way. The world was a very hostile place for humanity, apart from the kinds of energy that we have available in fossil fuels. And if we can come up with something better, I'm all for it. Let the free enterprise go for it. Let's find a better one. But right now, this is the best we have, and it's pretty doggone good. And we have enough natural gas, say, in America to power us for the next 1,000 years. And the idea that somehow we're destroying the earth is just a preposterous, uninformed position.
Well, and it's getting scarier all the time with kind of the Malthusian ideas that there are just too many people on the planet.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, I have a lot of friends on the Republican side of the aisle who feel that way, which is interesting. Only the most elite, actually. Republicans talk that way. But I think that maybe we need to start there. I really feel like a lot of what's motivating the environmental movement is this idea that humans are the enemy of life on Earth.
And it starts there. Preposterous truth. It is. You're exactly right. They somehow think that it's humanity that's the problem, that the Earth would be pristine and clean if it weren't for us. And I suppose you could make that case, but couldn't you make that case about Jupiter or Mars or some other planet? I mean, if your goal is to get rid of humanity, and that is the ultimate objective, well, I suppose then that we need to really reexamine our worldviews and say, what are we really trying to do here? If you're trying to have no impact on the Earth whatsoever, the idea of getting rid of fossil fuels is fine, but you also get rid of humanity in the process. And this notion that, you know, we're overpopulated, I mean, the truth is that there's still a significant marketplace going on in terms of population that kind of regulates itself. And right now, the Earth isn't anywhere close to being overpopulated. And as far as the resources that are necessary to sustain humanity, the average human being, on average, mathematically, produces about 1.5 times at least as much energy and resources as they consume. So the idea that a smaller population will be better for humanity is just doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
I'm talking with Congressman Trent Franks, my former boss. I still call him boss. And we're talking about, well, true stories in the oil patch and also just world dynamics and geopolitics of oil and gas. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. I'm continuing a conversation with Congressman Trent Franks, my former boss. We're talking oil, gas, Malthusian theories of there being too many people, and therefore the environment must take back control from the earth of the earth from mankind, and whether or not we agree with that. Of course, we don't. I was just thinking over the break that people try to argue that there's going to ultimately be warfare because too many humans are fighting over too few resources. And I heard this just this weekend, and it occurred to me, wait a minute, was there really less war when there were fewer people on the planet? I mean, I heard a friend of mine, he's a Marine. He's now in his 70s, but he did split tours in Vietnam. And he's a student of warfare in world history. He said, in 3,000 years of history, recorded history, there are an estimated 298 years of peace. And that is all. Less than 10% of our time that we know about on this planet was peaceful. And I said to him, you know, that probably means that somewhere deep in the reaches of the Amazon, some tribes, as yet undiscovered by civilization, were fighting a war during those 298 years of peace. I think there probably have been 0 years of peace.
Yeah.
Wherever there are two groups of humans, they will find something to fight about, whether it's hunting grounds, oil reserves, bananas. I don't know. There will always be a reason. And it doesn't have to be, you know, we divide ourselves by race or religion or region or area. Where everybody's the same race, we'll fight about who's Catholic and who's Protestant. We'll find a reason. There will always be a reason to fight. So anyway, I didn't mean to take the floor, but that is my analysis. I really think it doesn't make any difference. Wherever there's like too few resources, we invent something to create more.
Yeah.
Right? Like we're feeding so many more people, like billions more people today than we were in 1980 because we're using natural gas-derived fertilizer that quadruples the crop yield.
Right.
Wow.
Correct.
There's always something that we can do rather than demonize human life. What are your thoughts?
I couldn't agree with you more, Jackie. You know, the same God that made humanity somehow equipped us with an enormous ingenuity and capability to adapt to the circumstances that we deal with. And fossil fuels and civilization and a lot of the things that we have now are just kind of living examples of that. And it is true that humanity has been warlike. And I think that's one of the reasons why some of us hold so deeply to the ideal of America, that we hold certain truths to be self-evident, that we're all created, we're all equal in the sight of God, and that we should treat each other as such, and that we should have governments that protect people's individual rights, their right to live, their right to be free, and their right to pursue their dreams, to own property and build and do things that bring meaning and purpose to their lives. And if we somehow let go of that fairly simple but profound concept, I'm afraid that we will lose the greatest component of the miracle of life. And, you know, it's sad that your statements there do reflect an accurate view of history. And it should be something that we're always striving to make a better world and to trying to make sure that, you know, we can help those who have never had a clean drink of water, that we can do what we can to bring peace to the world and somehow recognize every person, no matter how weak or strong or what color they are or their station in life or their religious perspective, that we say, oh, wait a minute, the God that made us has a purpose and a plan for all of us. And if we just cooperate with that just a little and treat each other like fellow human beings, like brothers and sisters, and we would work together to meet the needs that we all have, then this place could be a walk in the park instead of a walk in Jurassic Park that sometimes it seems to be. And the truth is that I have great hopes for humanity, but I'm convinced that it's going to be important to have our eyes wide open and to be vigilant and to recognize that there are some things that are true and some things that are not. And that's not arrogance. It's just an observation. And we need to get away from so much speculative so-called science that's really science, political science, that people overlay their political ideas on science, and then it no longer is science. We need to look at things for what they are and work together to make them as they can be for every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. And we may never get there, but that should be what we strive for. And I believe if we do, that our children and grandchildren will say of us, as Ronald Reagan said, that we justified our brief moment here.
Right. Well, and you've devoted your professional life to producing oil and gas. And your political life, of course, was in the State House in Arizona, also in Congress, also in an executive agency in Arizona, and other things you're still doing. A lot of people would take aim at you for producing oil and gas. They don't understand what it is that you're doing to basically make sure people are alive and fed. I try to explain, you don't even have modern pharmaceuticals without petrochemicals. You don't have modern sanitation. Our lifespans would be just as they were. Up until the Industrial Revolution, the average lifespan was about 40 years old. And if you factored in all of the children that were born, stillborn, or didn't make it to age 5, it was more like 25 on average. And then came the Industrial Revolution, and boom, life became as we know it.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's my argument for why. No, what you're doing is actually very pro-human. It's very pro-life. It's life-sustaining. But most people in your business tend to apologize for what they're doing. And you look at these big companies, the big oil and gas companies, in their public statements, it's like they're promising to commit suicide Like, here's what we're doing to be low carbon and net zero by, you know, a certain time period or whatever. Wow. I think that's terrible. I mean, I think if you're not proud of what you're doing, if you cannot articulate why you bring value, I have to wonder why you're doing it. Oh, it's, the answer is for money, right? They don't get money off Wall Street for, you know, ESG scores that are poor unless they say these crazy things. But I think in your position, you don't have to do that as much, right? Because you're more of a self-functioning, I mean, you know, you're not a public company. So you can more say what you want and be independent and free. So how is that different for you? Because you're very unapologetic. You just tell the truth and you're proud of what you do.
Well, that's true. I'm grateful for the opportunity to get to do what I do. And I believe it keeps the lights on in children's hospitals across the world and keeps production for food going and helps absolutely billions of people, and that we don't have a good alternative to that right now. And if we got rid of fossil fuels in a moment, I can't express the kind of cataclysm that would take place. I think natural gas is going to be maybe the thing that will bring everyone together, because it pollutes so little and it is so plentiful. And I think that may be where we hit in terms of maybe transitioning someday to something like a nuclear energy of some sort that works better. But in the meantime, we have to take the reality for where it is. And Jackie, I can say to you honestly, that is deeply my commitment. You know, I have everything a man could dream of in my own life. There's nothing that I want. But the work that I do, I hope that it leaves behind a better world and it helps people find a better way in life. And, you know, especially I think it's important to focus on children, as you and I worked so hard to do when we were in Congress. And I think it's important that no matter what size company you're in, if you're doing the right thing, that you do not let these woke idiots somehow scare you off of principle. If we have the courage to stand up and say, no, you figure out how to do this, you show us a better plan and we'll be open to it. But we're not open to you just, you know, ignorantly saying things that will result in absolute cataclysm. I remember when I was in the fourth grade, the Weekly Reader that talked about in their feature article how we were all going to freeze to death.
Right.
And now, of course, it's global warming. And in about the last 170 years, I think the globe has increased on average about 1 degree Celsius, which has actually made it more livable, not less livable. And the truth is, until people get a hold of the reality, we're going to be in trouble. And ultimately, the way that's going to happen is that people who know the truth and are sincerely trying to do the right thing have the courage to get up and speak the truth and say, this is the truth. Show me where I'm wrong. And I hope that is something that we'll learn more as a people, because truth and time travel on the same road. And if we just decide that we're going to mindlessly get rid of things like fossil fuels without having some replacement, I promise you the repercussions will make themselves known. And people will understand in retrospect. The media will never hold the left accountable for it, but they'll understand in retrospect how wrong that they were, as has been the case in so many left-wing lunatic ideas for so much of history.
I love the expression, truth and time follow the same road. Because you don't cheat the truth. You might cheat it temporarily. You might fool people into believing that you've cheated it. You know, or you might fool some people some of the time. But with enough time passage, the truth will be made known. Yeah. Right, so.
I've always said that conservatives are very fortunate. Even though they don't have any a truck or an influence in the media, it seems like. It seems like we get killed on every front, whether it's the print media or the electronic media or just the big tech. We seem to be almost frozen out of it in terms of fair debate. But the truth is a wonderful ally, and over time, it will prevail.
I love that. Here at The Blaze, you know, Glenn Beck always says, the truth lives here. The truth lives here, which makes the network very attractive for someone like me, who wants to be free to tell the truth. And Trent Branks is a truth teller, you know, grade A, unadulterated truth teller. And so proud to have him back. Congressman Franks, thank you for being with us again.
Oh, it's my sweet honor to be with you, Jackie, and thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Always welcome on this show, sir. You all are listening to the Jackie Daly Show. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show. Find me online, JackieDaly.com. It's Jackie with no E and Daily Like Every Day. And there on the website, you can find some videos, various panels or shows I've been on. You can find my social media. You can subscribe for free at iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, and others. Okay, just handed to me by Jeff Fisher of Chewing the Fat with Jeff Fisher, also a frequent guest on Glenn Beck's show here on The Blaze. It says this statistic: the Keystone Oil Pipeline leaked more than 14,000 barrels of oil in Kansas last week. Okay. Largest spill in the pipeline's history, enough to fill a swimming pool. And then there was a different leak that was slightly larger in 2010, according to Bloomberg. Okay. I said, okay, this is just a paragraph. I said, my first reaction, my first thought is, how does a spill like this compare to, let's say, natural oil and gas seepage, whether onto the ocean floor or onto the land? People don't talk about this, but this is a natural phenomenon. Oil and gas actually seep up, you know, come up from the earth and cover the ground or cover the ocean naturally, all by themselves, all the time, all day long, since the beginning of time, probably. I'll give you one very famous example that I saw myself when I went to Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is the teeny little country between the north of Iran and then Chechnya, the former Soviet republics. To its east is the Caspian Sea. To its west is Armenia, with whom it is like perpetually at war. Anyway, little Azerbaijan is actually a very cool country because it is an oil or petrostate, let's call it. Its name, Azerbaijan, literally translates to burning land. Why is it burning land? Because literally, I was there, I toured this and saw it myself. Azerbaijan has something they call it the Burning Mountain. That mountain is on fire. It is on fire. It has been on fire probably for as long as mankind has ever known it to exist. You can Google this. It's very cool. And look, it doesn't look like some big massive, you know, Mount Sinai inferno. What it is literally, it looks like, I would say, like, here's, you know, 20 foot by 2 foot of land that's on fire. And then let's go, you know, 100 yards down the mountain, and there will be another strip. Maybe it's 40 foot by 3 foot of fire. And this fire burns constantly. Why? Because there literally are hydrocarbons. And kids, when I say hydrocarbons, I mean oil, gas, or coal, that are right there at the surface. There is so much. Remember, Baku, Azerbaijan was the big oil field, the very first oil field in the world. In fact, I visited it. That the Nobels and the Rothschilds funded. You can still see the very first pipeline there in 1846. I have a photo of it, in fact, on my social media and on my website. It's wooden. They were made of wood back then. And you can still view it. But the point is, oil was so plentiful that you could literally just get it out of the ground easier there than anywhere else on Earth, as far as I know. It was obvious to them. That's how they discovered it, because it was so close to the surface. And so I'm telling you that it just fuels this fire all the time. I saw it myself. The same is true in certain springs in the United States. You know, people back home in Appalachia know this. Sometimes you will see bubbles coming up through the creeks and streams. That's natural gas. We have a shale formation on the eastern side of Ohio called the Utica, which also overlays a shale formation called the Marcellus, which is a monster natural gas shale play that's, you know, mostly in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, New York, but it also extends a little bit, I think, into Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, and that's where I'm from, is that Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia area. The point is, when we talk about oil spills, most of the time, if you look into it, these are very, very, very small amounts of oil or natural gas. And the amount of damage they do, if it's not into it like a water supply, is debatable. And understand that, for example, there's methane on the ocean floor, naturally occurring, lots and lots and lots of methane. This is natural. Oil is natural. Natural gas is natural. Mother Nature made these things. And sometimes they move about from the reservoir onto the ocean floor or onto the ground. It's normal. It's natural. This is nothing to panic about. It does not require our management. It does not require federal funds. It does not require, you know, green groups to go survey it, remove it, worry about it. That would be a waste of time. Like trying to stop the currents of the ocean or wind. Please understand, I mean, I've just about got to the point that I've learned certain people who we call alarmists actually specialize in taking things that are perfectly natural and calling them a crisis. Like there's something wrong with what nature created or invented. So, I mean, who's in charge here? Us or nature? And I'll make a confession. I'm about to upset people who like me, which I'm a master of that. I even don't understand perfectly wildlife management. Like, or even the idea that certain species are not native. A certain member of my household is constantly upset that there are species all over the place that are not native. Now, what it means is that they cause a disturbance to the balance that we have become accustomed to for whatever reason. For agriculture, whatever it is, it changes the balance. But I don't know that nature considers that a massive problem. I mean, nature will adjust over time. The earth maintained itself for a long, long, long time before we got here. How did it do it? How did it manage it? Has anyone thought about this? There are certain scientists who will tell you that nature existed all by itself for hundreds of millions of years or billions of years before we ever came along. Okay, if you are a person who believes the biblical view that everything was made in 7 days, or 6 days rather, on the seventh day God rested, I will say to you, even there, the Bible says that one day is as 1,000 years to God. We are not on the same time frame. Time is not measured the same biblically as it is by us. That is a fact. I'm just telling you what it says, okay? The point is, regardless of which you believe, the earth was here before us. The animals, the plants, everything. Without our genius to micromanage every little microaggression or mistake of nature. And so I just don't sweat this stuff that much. The fact that you can identify changes, like changes from an invasive species or changes from methane on the ocean floor, does not indicate a problem to me. You know, I got a lot of things to worry about. You know, natural oil seepage in a burning mountain in Azerbaijan that no doubt is emitting carbon and methane like crazy all day, every day for thousands of years. I can't worry about that. I just can't. I'm out of worry. I'm out of energy for worrying about that. But you know what? If we go tell certain groups of fringe environmentalists that there is a mountain on fire in Azerbaijan, I'm telling you, they don't know that and they would view it as a crisis. So, anyway, all that to say, just to keep it in perspective, there is no risk-free way to move energy, even the wind and solar and batteries, right? There are definitely big risks. It's environmentally harmful to mine the earth to get the rare earth elements for the wind and the solar and the batteries. They're toxic. How do you dispose of this stuff? is not biodegradable. It chops up birds and bats by the millions or even billions over time. So everything has its pros and cons. Don't panic. Oil on the ground is actually not unnatural. Oil in the ocean is actually not unnatural. Remember, I think it was there was a member of Congress in the Judiciary Committee when I worked there who claimed there wouldn't be life in the Gulf of Mexico for 100 years because of the BP oil spill. Can you imagine getting by with talking like that? What kind of nonsense is that? It's fine. Nature has seen this all before many, many times and doesn't need a member of Congress, I think from Houston, Texas, to tell God and Mother Nature what to do about it. So at a time, you're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. I cannot believe what I just did last segment. Last segment, I said, Jeff Fisher handed me a paragraph about an oil spill from the Keystone Pipeline that was quite minimal in the grand scheme of, you know, oil on the ground in planet Earth. I talked about that. Guess what I did not do? I did not read to you the Google search that I immediately performed, which was, you can Google this. Actually, I don't Google. You know this, right? I DuckDuckGo, or I Gibberoo, G-I-B-A-R-U, DuckDuckGo, Gibberoo, a little more privacy-respecting than Google, a little less prone to censor and tell you what to think by shadow banning people and all that business that that Mr. Musk, is a fine Texan now, is telling you about what's happening. Here's what I did. I went to DuckDuckGo, and I typed in oil seeps onto land to try to find scientific authorities that explain that, yes, oil and gas seepage onto land is natural. It happens all the time. It happens on the ocean floor. Here is what came up on DuckDuckGo. First of all, this is the website is oceanservice.noaa.gov. That is your agency here in the United States. What, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They are the repository for U.S. climate data, by the way. They are the authority, whether you trust them or not. They have they're the first hit, and the article is titled, What is an Oil Seep? Okay, this is the NOAA.gov, run by a bunch of Democrats, not me, their article. It says this, an oil seep is a natural leak of crude oil and gas that migrates up through the seafloor and ocean depths. And then they have here a beautiful photograph of what this looks like on the ocean floor. And below it says, a natural tar seep offshore of Gaviota in Santa Barbara, California. This is Santa Barbara, right? Which is, as you might know, a very oil-rich area. And as you might know, there have been oil slicks in Santa Barbara. I understand why that upsets people. That would upset me too if I lived in Santa Barbara. And, you know, if people saw this, their first thought would be, oh, this is caused by the oil spill in Santa Barbara. No, this is a natural seep. It says this, did you know naturally occurring oil seeps from the seafloor are the largest source of oil entering the world ocean? In fact, they account for nearly half of the oil released into the ocean environment every year. Seeps occur when crude oil leaks from fractures in the seafloor or rises up through seafloor sediments, much the same way that a freshwater spring brings water to the surface. It says, NOAA's Office of Response and Restoration is interested in oil seeps because they are predictable places to observe oil behavior. Yes, I know I want to observe oil behavior. That sounds riveting. Sounds like watching paint dry. You do know that paint is derived from oil, right? It's a petrochemical derived from petroleum. But for oil, you wouldn't have paint. The kind you've grown accustomed to, you know. you would have paint like the Scottish Picts, you know, who went to war and painted themselves blue, but you wouldn't have acrylic. You wouldn't have beautiful nail polish. You wouldn't have beautiful paint on your walls. Okay, back to my DuckDuckGo search. Natural oil seeps in Southern California. Slicks of seep oil may also be associated with bubbling of natural gas at the ocean surface. Next, we go to marine.usgeologicalsurvey.gov data. Article is titled, What Are Oil and Gas Seeps? Oil and gas seeps are natural springs where liquid and gaseous hydrocarbons leak out of the ground, whereas freshwater springs are fed by underground pools of water. Oil and gas seeps are fed by natural underground accumulations of oil and natural gas. And they have beautiful photos. A vertical slice through the earth explaining how this works. Or if you prefer, if you don't like the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or the U.S. Geological Survey, go to Wikipedia. In some places, it's a firing offense. It's not authoritative. But guess what? They also have a big write-up there on what is a petroleum seep. Or scienceandthesea.org, oil seeps in the Gulf of Mexico seen from space. They're so big, you can see them from space. There, see? Now, don't you feel better? The next time that some clown reporter tells you that you need to, like, lose your mind because 16,000 gallons, not barrels, gallons of oil were spilled somewhere in the middle of nowhere, North Dakota, and that's supposed to be the end of our lives, but we should shut down, you know, an international pipeline that keeps us off of OPEC and Russia. No. Please do yourself a favor. Google oil seeps onto land or into the ocean and just start reading. And you're going to feel immediately better about the entire situation. Knowledge dispels fear. That's what King Alfred used to say. The first king of England. Knowledge dispels fear. When the Vikings were coming to slaughter every Saxon, his plan was to educate them so they would not fear. Don't fear. Fear is terrible. You make all kinds of ridiculous, horrible decisions if you act in fear. It shuts down the critical thinking. But, you know, you take one story like this about one oil spill that is a drop in the bucket of the oil spilt onto the earth by Mother Nature since the beginning of time, and it's a news story. I'm not saying we shouldn't report it. I'm not. I'm just saying, stay calm. Stay cool. Kids are too afraid. The younger generation is terrified. They're very snowflakey. They have lower testosterone levels than their parents and certainly their grandparents. By the way, I got some fan mail that somehow I missed from my interview with Candace Owens way back in 2021. I got an email from a guy who runs a testosterone center here in Dallas. And he was like, hey, I saw your interview with Candace Owens about testosterone. Man, you are right on. It is awesome people are talking about this. I've been on this forever. This is great. People need to learn. And they do. And they do. If you missed that, it's on my website. It was actually through PragerU. But a great discussion about how testosterone levels have fallen like 50% since just a few decades ago. Wonder how much since the beginning of mankind. We used to be a lot more warlike. I wonder if we can become more peaceful. I do not think that violent crime is going down, so probably not. Where are the benefits of all this? Okay, well, listen, I love to hear from you. As we're talking about this fan mail business, I do love to hear from you. I do read what you send me. Some of you send me articles every week and say, why aren't you using my articles? Answer, I'm a little overwhelmed. I get bombarded constantly. People send me books to read. They want me to talk about their book. People email me their articles, what they're working on, what's going on, a project they want people to invest in. I don't sell stuff. Yeah, I sell nothing. I don't give investment advice. And by the way, I cannot promote oil and gas deals, because that's like selling securities. It is a security, and you have to register to do that. I'm not doing that. I got enough on my plate. Thank you very much. So I don't do that. But I do talk about books, because books are ideas. That's different. And I have here in front of me, let me pull these out. In the next segment, I'm going to talk about mail from listeners. I pulled a couple that I thought were really fun. That, you know, people think that I should not miss certain articles. And I appreciate that. I do. And as I said, whether I respond to you or not, because I get so much daggone email, I do read. I do read what you send to me. So please be encouraged. You can find me very easily. If you want to communicate with me, go to Twitter, at Jackie Daily Host. You can probably actually find me now that Mr. Musk has taken over Twitter. It's Jackie with no E, daily, like everyday, host. And you can also find me through the website. There is a way to contact me there at JackieDaily.com. So please, be encouraged. And obviously on my Facebook page, which is The Jackie Daily Show, it's crafted as a fan page. It's not my personal page. That's a different page. Or Instagram, Jackie Daily. I'll take a break. I'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. And listen, I love to hear from you. Please be encouraged to contact me, as I said in the last segment. And I repeat again, if you want to talk with me and continue the conversation or send me articles or things that you want to follow up on from my interviews, I'm easy to find. Go to Twitter, at Jackie Daily Host, or Facebook, The Jackie Daily Show, Instagram, Jackie Daily. That is Jackie with no E, only five letters, and daily like every day. So I received a note from Steve in San Diego saying that he really appreciated the interview I did with Major Fred Galvin, which was all about how Major Galvin and his men, who were members of the first Special Operations Group inside the U.S. Marine Corps, MARSOC, were falsely accused of war crimes and put through the longest trial in U.S. military history and acquitted across the board on all charges. And they name the names of the top brass who accused them and explain the political motivation that they believe, or that Major Galvin believed they had. And so the book is called A Few Bad Men. Steve from San Diego really liked it. I'll tell you, I was upset for days after talking with Major Galvin. I mean, I was really, really rattled. That could be done to some of the finest, most courageous, most brave Americans who volunteered for some of the toughest duty. You know, one of those Marines returning fire while he was on fire. And they fought their way out of there with not a single casualty. And then to have our leadership turn on them because it was politically expedient. That's my interpretation. And it really, really, I mean, it upset me for days. I thought about it for days. I read the entire book, cover to cover, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And it seems like all of these, you know, political persecutions and prosecutions, false accusations, ending in acquittals, they all seem to have the same elements. The screw job that is done on people, it's like there's a model. There's a pattern. And now I'm seeing it everywhere. My eyes are open to it. And I want to share with you when I find these examples. So Steve sent to me an article that reminded him of the Major Galvin story. It's titled Hero of the Left. Ms. Jones pleads guilty to computer crimes. This was in hotair.com by David Strom. Bottom line, a woman who worked at the Florida Department of Health became a darling of certain control freaks in the government and the press because she attacked Governor Ron DeSantis for his COVID policies. Okay. Yeah, kind of a dime a dozen stuff. You're thinking, oh, but wait. Apparently, situation is this. She admitted that she hijacked, according to Mr. Strom, the Florida Department of Health's computer system, did not tell the truth about that, and stole data from the system. Okay. She was arrested last year. She actually ran for Congress while she was under investigation and awaiting trial. And resolved the case by a deferred prosecution. It's kind of like you admit to what you've done without being convicted. Texas has the same thing. And if she abides by a certain agreement, she will not be prosecuted. I think what that means is technically she's not a convict. Technically, you're not guilty. You're not pleading guilty, right? You're not pleading that you are. You'll be convicted of a crime. She'll pay money, $20,000, perform community service, and seek mental health assistance. Okay. It's an interesting deferred prosecution. It's kind of an interesting invention. So, and I'm no Florida lawyer, but the point is, this person got slapped on the wrist. If I did what she did, why do I have a feeling? And I took aim at Cuomo in New York or Newsom in California instead of her attacking DeSantis. Why do I have a feeling that I would be treated differently? Because, you know, she gave these great talking points to people who wanted to attack DeSantis. And now the truth comes out, you know, with a teeny tiny little megaphone compared to the one used with her facts to attack DeSantis. I mean, that's what we're seeing over and over. When I find these stories, this woman being adjudicated, I want you to know about it. The authorities should be exposed for this kind of behavior. Okay, also, more mail from Bill, who writes to me often. I get lots and lots and lots of stories from Bill. He saw my posting about how the climate activists are gluing themselves to the highway, you know, or throwing tomato soup onto the Mona Lisa, or gluing themselves to find works of art. And each time I see that, I'll tweet this story. And at the top of it, I say, well, this should solve some problems, right? What is this about? Okay, so Bill sends to me a Slate article titled this, How Gluing Oneself to Something and Ungluing Actually Works. The climate protesters use super glue so it will last longer, which, of course, is a petroleum product, as I'm always telling you. And Bill's very smart. He then followed up with, hey, and take a look at this article about, you know, whether or not glue is a fossil fuel-derived product. Apparently, you know, every true vegan knows that many glues are vegan. They're vegan, but not super glue. I'll tell you about this very quickly because I was interested. Here's the deal. Super glue is 100% ethyl to cyanoacrylate. Cyanoacrylate. Anything that says ethyl in the front, not ethyl like your grandma, ethyl like E-T-H-Y-L. There's your first clue. Here's the deal. Most types of super glue are made with synthetic polymers, complex polymers you are highly unlikely to stumble upon in the wild. Apparently, complex polymers can be derived from petroleum and other materials, says the blog Green Matters. It's important you know this stuff. Super glue likely features non-animal ingredients. The industrial scale processes whereby complex polymers are converted into super glue and its variations are likely harmful for the environment. What's more, super glue accelerators frequently contain acetone, a common ingredient of nail varnish removers, paint removers, and other items, and Science Direct describes this as harmful and toxic. While super glue is not derived from animal products, the production produces or processes required to create it on an industrial scale are likely highly damaging. Yes, bad, bad, bad. Super glue is bad. Yet the environmentalists use it to glue themselves to the highway. Did you see that in France and elsewhere? Here they are. It says, activists from the Just Stop Oil campaign group with hands glued to the frame of the painting The Hay Wain by English artist John Constable. And, they're crouched down with their hands glued to this beautiful frame of what appears to be a fine work of art in a museum. Protesters attempting to raise awareness over climate change have taken up some wild antics the last few weeks, throwing soup across a Van Gogh painting at the National Gallery in London, throwing mashed potatoes at a Monet in Germany, chucking cake at the Mona Lisa. Yes, this should solve some problems. These stunts, executed by activists, are an attempt to draw attention to the climate crisis and encourage everyone to coalesce and work to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Right. When you see clown show, clown car people glue themselves to works of art, what you're thinking is, I know what I need to do. I need to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. That's exactly what you were thinking, right? When I told you about that. That's exactly what came to mind. So, there have been attempts to defend, diminish, and contextualize the specific form of protest. We'll leave that to others to litigate. So says the people at Slate. Not only are they throwing foods at items, valuable items, they are gluing themselves to them. That's right. Blah, blah, blah. Because it's part of the awareness erasing. It's happening often. Okay. There was a man who glued his head to the girl with the pearl earring painting at The Hague. Well, and I know The Hague is better for it, right? They claim no significant damage was done to the paintings. Do we buy that? Tomato soup is acidic, and you throw it on the Mona Lisa? What? I'm not allowed to put my fingers on it, but it's okay if this dude throws acidic tomatoes onto the Mona Lisa? Jeff Fisher informs me they're all in cases. So you're saying they're gluing themselves to the case. I'm not sure that's right, Jeffy. That's not what it looks like here in Slate.com. Okay. Well, the case would be transparent. Thank you, Jeffy. I feel so much smarter now. Now we can all support the super gluing of oneself to paintings at The Hague, because it's really not going to hurt the Mona Lisa's oil painting beneath the acrylic or whatever was going on. No, the whatever it was. Well, that's good. Okay, I can stop then. I feel so much better now. I was losing sleep about it until Jeffy. He's on this. He's on it. Thank God I keep him around. He's right. I'm looking at him right through the glass. I'm out of time again. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Listen, I'm looking at the long-term projections for weather trends for the next 2 to 4 weeks. Sometimes these things are accurate, sometimes they're not. You know what? They often are. This is not your like weatherman on News Channel 4. This is the stuff that the day traders look at to know, you know, what's going to be the price of natural gas in the next few weeks, or coal or whatever. First of all, it says, expect a white Christmas, America. Like most of us, even down to Texas, are supposed to have a dusting of snow around Christmas time. But the bad news is it's going to be really, really cold. Like similar to the storm that we had in 2021 for some people. This could be a major problem. There will be precipitation. There will be cold. I am warning you because I don't want you to be caught by surprise. And even if it's not December, even if this report is wrong and the trends and winds and currents change, it is just a matter of time. I want you to be prepared. Just know our grids are becoming far less stable Your power supply is becoming less and less stable every day if you're a Texan or a Californian. And in many states, not every state, but many states, you're going to have less than before, if you can believe that, because of bad policy. So I feel like I've overdone the warning. I mean, I feel like I'm John the Baptist crying in the wilderness and people don't listen. They don't want to hear it. But you know what? For those of you who do listen, sometimes you have to be told multiple times. I want you to have, please, food stocked up at your house, medicine stocked up at your house. I'm looking right now at a photograph out of Toronto from a friend of mine. Totally empty shelves right now in Toronto for children's Tylenol and fever reducer, for just regular fever and painkiller for adults. The shelves are empty. There's not one single box. Imagine your child has a fever right now. I mean, there are some places where the RSV or whatever is thick. The time to stock up on things is when there's not a crisis, when it's easy to find, when it's plentiful and cheap. And this goes for fuel. You know, if you have a big tank that holds gas to heat your home, fill it up, right? The gas tanks in your cars, keep them filled up, please. Anywhere that you can store energy, if you have a wood-burning fireplace, please stock up on wood or coal. I'm telling you, a medical supply, a sterile supply, you just don't know when things will get bad. But by the looks of this report, this weather report that I'm looking at right now, that is circulating among the day trading community to help them know how to invest, it's looking like extreme severe weather. And one of these came from Joe Bastardi. Do you remember Joe Bastardi? He was on the show with his book not too long ago. Maybe it might have been a year ago. And he's on Sean Hannity somewhat regularly. Big personality. But he's kind of an expert in the weather. And he seems very concerned. So I'm saying to you, you know, if you're going to store fuel, gasoline, diesel, whatever, like in tanks, there are laws in every state that govern how that's done, and safety guidelines. Please, if you're going to do that, and I encourage you to do it, please just read up on how to do it safely and how to do it legally. I can't give you legal advice. Every state's different, so you have to be advised by someone in your state. But really, you can just look this up online. It's easy to find. But I want you to have what you need. I don't want to scare you, but now's the time. And by the way, get a generator. And for all the bad things that I point out about solar energy as a industrial or national scale energy source, you know what? It's fine in an emergency. It's fine for, you know, those little battery packs that power your cell phone with solar or power your security lights or, you know, little gadgets like that that you need in a pinch. Great. You can buy that stuff just about anywhere. I have solar-powered lanterns at home that you can get from Patriot Supply. Just a lot of things. So wherever it's convenient, if you can afford it, I mean, it's kind of a luxury item. There's nothing wrong with it, but the taxpayer shouldn't have to pick up the tab to do this nationally when we have better things like fossil fuels or nuclear or hydropower to power our homes. But there, you know, all energy is good energy. If you have none, right? Buy batteries. Buy crank radios, things that you can actually power organically. Have candles around so you have light. Have matches. Have waterproof matches. In fact, you can go on to, you know, Bass Pro Shops or Scheels. We have a Scheels here, S-C-H-E-E-L-S. These are fine stores that have all the survival gear, everything that you need to camp or go off the grid, you know, you can find it there. Sleeping bags. What if you lose power? You would appreciate then. Anything that keeps you warm. Or even like, I have like skiing outfits at home. If I were freezing in my house, that's what I would put on. Why not? Why not? You can also buy the little packets that you bust them open and they heat up. I was at an outdoor wedding at the governor's mansion earlier in the month. And that's what they did. It was freezing cold, pouring down the rain. I was in layers. They were handing out free scarves and these free packets that a hunter would put in their pocket to keep their hands warm. You can buy even heated socks for when you're out fly fishing. You plug them in, assuming you have power, and they'll keep you quite warm in a mountain stream. So, 1,000 ideas. Even buy like a little burning pit that you would need in a pinch. Think about it. What are you going to burn in your house if you really have to? So, I'm sorry we have to think this way, but the truth is our leadership has not served us well in many decisions they've made over the years. And now we find ourselves with an unreliable grid. And I'm trying to tell you that the weather reports, as they stand today, suggest there could be a white Christmas. It's far more likely than not for most of America, and an extreme cold spell. And if it's not December, it will be soon. So, look out for yourself. You know what? Even better, go buy hunting gear. I just bought a bow and arrow that I love. I don't have much upper body strength. I'm a small, dainty kind of woman. I can pull a 40-pound bow. I can do it. I mean, I'm lethal with it. I can absolutely fell dinner with it. So I just did some quail hunting this weekend. Keep your skills sharp. Guess what? I also bought a Strikeman for several people in my life. Strikeman, you've probably seen it on TV. And they're not paying me, by the way. I'm not being paid to push any of this. This is an app you can use. You put a laser on your pistol. And you can do target practice without burning any ammo. I mean, ultimately, you'd save a ton of money. You can practice drawing. You can practice anything you want to do with Strikeman. It will tell you what you hit, where you hit it, improve your accuracy, expending no ammo, because you know what? It's expensive. It's really hard to get your hands on it sometimes, which is kind of scary. Again, as I said before, the time to hoard things is not when they're scarce and not in an emergency. All of that has to be done ahead of time. So please, buy all of these things now. And things you don't even think about, like for your bow and arrow, buy the Nox, right? Buy the arrowheads. Buy all of the lubricants that you need to keep things working. All that and ancillary stuff. Think about it. And maybe you haven't been hunting in years. You know what? Go. Because you're going to remember, oh yeah, I need chaps if I'm going to hunt in the brush. Believe me, you don't want to hunt without chaps in the brush. I've done it. Buy your rattlesnake boots. If you live in Texas and your rattlesnake chaps. Did you know there are rattlesnake chaps? I didn't. I saw them this weekend. I'm out hunting in Alabama, and they wear rattlesnake chaps down there. And I said, come on, I need some of that. Guess what someone's getting for Christmas? Rattlesnake chaps. Does that sound exciting? I thought it was very cool. Anyway, 1,000 things that can make your life easier if you ever really have to live off the land. But you won't know what these things are unless you actually go out and practice once in a while. And, yeah, there's no substitute for experience. So, do everything safely. Always. Always. Go buy extra ear protection, extra eye protection. All the things you have to have that you're not thinking about when you're preparing. Please. Please. Why do I lecture you like this? Because I love you so much. I'm like, I sound like my grandma. I'm turning into grandma already. I just lost her last weekend. Loved my grandma, and now I'm turning into her already, lecturing you endlessly about how to stay alive. Bad times. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show.